Right before the podcast starts, I've got an apology to make. Doddy's microphone didn't work in this, unfortunately. We didn't realise, we recorded it, didn't work. So Doddy is going to sound a bit weird, not as good as myself and Martin sound, of course. His microphone isn't working, but you'll get used to it after a while. Anyway, here it comes. Okay, it's the Mountain Bike Podcast presented by GMBN. And this week is a retro podcast. We've got Retro Week going on YouTube, on the channel, with loads of old bike shenanigans going on. So I thought, why not get some of the old schoolers into a room, myself included, of course. I've got Martin.
Hello.
And Doddy.
All right.
Let's talk about how mountain biking has changed over the years. All sorts, really. Bring up some funny stories. I guess we've all been riding a long time. For me, like the early, mid-90s when I started, and that was like the heyday for me. I used to consume everything mountain biking then, so I've got lots of good stories. But I guess we're all pretty similar, right?
Yeah, now. I think our first time was, but we're actually 89.
All right.
My dad's mate used to play badminton with. He brought home a copy, very first copy of MBUK.
Why?
And he gave it to me. Oh, you might want to read that.
So MBUK's been around longer than I thought.
Yeah, I think October 88, I think. Rings a bell, maybe earlier, but it was in 88, it unofficially launched.
Wow, that's amazing.
I didn't know that.
I'm trying to think when I first got into mountain biking, but I don't think I got into it as early as you did, Doddy, but I remember the first, I've got one up on my screen now, I remember the first mountain bike I saw, and it was a Rally Maverick.
Yeah.
And it would have been in about 1985, or maybe 86, looking at this picture, 85 or 86, but I remember seeing my brother ride it around at a big horse event, and they had a rally, had like a trade stand there, and they were showing off this new thing. And the incredible thing about it, it was that what it could climb up, you know, because it had this granny ring that was just a new thing. No bikes the had granny rings.
Were they called granny rings then? Probably
you know what? I don't know, but I just remember him going, I can ride up any hill. And he was just blown away about it. And it was too big for me. I would never have been able to get on it at that point. But I remember these super wide handlebars and just like knobbly tires. And when you look back at it, it looks horrendous.
It looks kind of like a touring bike.
Yeah, but it was, at the time, I just remember thinking, oh my God, that's the coolest thing ever. And my brother, who could ride it, was just like, that was it. He just thought it was the greatest thing ever invented.
I sort of remember, well, it might have been the Rally Burner colours, but almost like the colours of this T-shirt, you know, the lines of like yellow and blue and hologram stickers.
It has the stripes on it, doesn't it?
I guess that's probably later. But mountain biking isn't really very old at all. We're talking late 70s, early 80s. So that was early on in the days of mountain biking, really. Me and Dolly went to Marin County last year to go and do a tour of the Mountain Bike Museum and Hall of Fame and met Gary Fisher, Charlie Kelly, Joe Breeze, all those people. And it was cool. It's definitely before my time mountain biking, but great to learn about. And that video is coming out this weekend, hopefully. But it's cool to see like there's the bikes going through the years and how much they change as well. Mm. So much in those early days.
What's so Gary Fisher, he's someone I don't really, I kind of know his history, that he was there at the very beginning, but what's he like? I've never actually met Gary Fisher. What's he like to
very
meet?
Very charismatic.
Yeah.
He's
astute as a businessman, that's for sure.
A slightly older gentleman. I was surprised to see is actually he's just had a baby. How old is he? Late 70s?
You know what? I wouldn't want to guess.
Well, maybe that's really wrong of me to guess, but it was
wow. Just had a baby.
Yeah. Still very active.
Who's your dad? Gary Fisher. That's crazy.
But it's funny, he was a roadie originally.
A really good roadie.
Is that right?
Yeah, really
right.
Quite established one in Northern California.
I didn't know that at all.
And he was doing a lot of cyclocross before I had a name. So he was kind of a bit of a pioneer in a lot of things before he came to mountain biking.
Yeah, but every time I see him, I see like a photo of him or I see a magazine shoot. He's always dressed in some very quirky clothes. Yeah. He's got like some kind of crazy moustache going on and weird glasses. So is he like a kooky guy?
Definitely.
Or?
But it was cool. He invited us into his house. We sat there for a couple of hours and just, you know, asked some questions, listened to his stories, and all really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And he's got loads of stuff knocking around the house, old bits of frames. And he's still working on lots of really positive cycle advocacy schemes to try and get more people riding bikes worldwide. It's really interesting, actually.
Yeah, a lot of it was e-bike related, actually.
Yeah. So he's now involved with Trek. So yeah. Gary Fisher, the brand, was bought out by Trek a long time ago, I suppose, and he works for them.
Though. That's interesting, actually, isn't it? Because Gary Fisher was bought out by Trek, but what have they done with that brand? I mean, is it still a big part of their kind
it's
of
not
range?
It's not really. No, it was Fisher Bikes for quite a long time. And it was part of the Trek range. They always had Fisher as a side range.
Yeah.
Obviously had his Geometry, his G2 and his G1.
Right.
So his Genesis. So he was pushing longer bikes to start with and then putting more offset to make the handling feel like a shorter bike.
Mm.
And I guess they're just using that technology and moved that across to some of the Trek range.
Right, right.
I guess Trek just is a bigger brand, isn't it? Yeah. There's more to do.
And how much was he bought out for? I mean, do you know those numbers, Doddy? You know the numbers of everything. Come on.
I'd expect he's done quite well over the years, I think.
Yeah, I hope so.
He sounds like quite a comfortable man.
Yeah. I hope so.
Another a brand I was thinking of, Klein. They were very cool.
Yeah.
I remember, so when I grew up, there was a few pros in my town, Ian Collins and Andrew Titley.
Yeah.
I'm sure Titley had a sort of pinky purple.
Yeah, the Attitude.
Yeah, riding around town like that. I was like blown away.
Beautiful bike.
And then I think they were bought by Trek as well, Klein Bikes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I might be wrong.
Yeah. It was Gary Klein who designed them originally, yeah.
Yeah, but those were one of the first bikes that got me really excited about mountain bikes. I remember seeing Tinker Juarez, I think it was, Tinker Juarez on a Klein and just being like, I mean, he looked cool too.
These are all custom painted, to make them even cooler.
Yeah, and I just remember it looking so radical and just the colours being so... Well, of that time, you know, that was like early 90s.
The bar, one piece bar stem, do you remember that?
Yeah, yes. Mission Control, that thing was amazing.
Yeah.
And they developed their own head tube size and their own sort of one piece fork.
Yeah.
Worth a lot of money nowadays, I would imagine. I bet there's lots of retro enthusiasts who pay a lot of money for those sort of bikes.
Yeah.
Because it is a big scene now, of course. Mm. And it's good to be in Marin County. And actually, we rode Repack, or I pushed up and rode Repack, which was. You know, it was before my time, all that stuff, but I'd learned about it through magazines like MBUK and learned the history of mountain biking a bit. Mm. And that is where they first started racing mountain bikes, just a bunch of mates pushing to the top of this hill and bombing down this fire road. And in the old book that I think you've got with you, Doddy.
I've got a copy there, yeah.
It's got the original times, and there's a rock at the top and a rock at the bottom. So you start with your foot on the rock and you race the bottom and then put your foot on the rock. And that's crazy. I did it, and it has changed. They were definitely, like Charlie Kelly was keen to say how it has changed. But it's still the same fire road, definitely a different surface. Yeah. But I put a time in that I thought was pretty good on this cheap Trek hardtail with a big beach cruiser seat that I found at the hotel. Yeah. And I was like a minute and a half off Gary Fisher's
time. I've got a bit of a theory here, right? Because you've already said Gary Fisher was a very astute man, right? Now, if I was a very astute man, what I would do is go down to that finishing rock and move it 200 metres further down the road
that's the rock I
would always have put my foot on, because over time, you know, it's changed and suddenly you've created a time that's forever unbelievable.
Well, I couldn't believe it, because they were just wearing, you know, double denim jeans and shirts bombing down the
just
hill
just for coaster brakes.
Yeah,
it's pretty nuts.
Pre-helmets, of course. And they must have been going, you know, 40-50 mile an hour at points down a gnarly fire road with a big exposure on the one side.
What you never see in the photos is how steep some of the bottom parts of it actually is. Quite surprising.
Really?
And I got to drift around this one corner that is super famous. Actually, I think it's on the cover of that book there. The picture that I remember of Repack, I was like, right, I've got to try and remake that on my crap beach cruiser thing. But it felt amazing. But sketchy, I had crap tyres, and as they would have had worse tyres, and it was very sketchy. You would want your jeans on, to be fair.
It's incredible when you think about that period of mountain biking, and you can say something like what you just said, pre-helmet. Like, what the hell is that all about? You can't do mountain biking without a helmet on.
Yeah.
But that's how it started.
That's the way it was. Well, a lot of, you know, road racers back in the day, well, none of them would wear helmets until not that long ago when it was made.
It wasn't. It was, I think, the first were like those leather sausage hat things.
Yeah, and horrible looking things.
I can't imagine they did anything.
No, they could take the helmets off as well until like the early 2000s thing. If they finished on a climb, they could drop their helmets at the bottom of the climb and ride up without it.
It's crazy. That is crazy.
I would definitely recommend it if anyone's in San Francisco to go up to Fairfax and check out that museum. It is amazing. You need to check the open hours. I think it's every day, but you know, it's worth
Let's talk about the bikes. What's the bike for you that def- that defines retro? As we're our subject this week is retro. So what's the bike? Because that Klein for me is kind of where I would start it. I'd be like, wow, that looked different. It was like the fat tubing. It was something that Cannondale was introducing as well. And
Cannondale, did you ride some of those sort of fat tubed Cannondales? The red, remember that really famous for me was your red hardtail that you did trials on. But that was
I rode a Cannondale, but I didn't start riding a Cannondale until 1995. And I think they had that kind of like, I remember seeing a friend at school with a Cannondale that had that kind of blue, white, red colorway on it. That would have been 1992 or 1993. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, that's the coolest bike I've ever seen. And I weirdly later found out actually that the kid who had that bike, he used to always have incredible mountain bikes, and he worked in a mountain bike shop. And he later got caught for actually stealing all of those bikes. and in later years, turned up in the mountain bike industry himself and worked for Cannondale, weirdly enough. But yeah, so he started his career as No, I'm not going to mention his name. He's a really nice guy, but yeah, maybe a slightly troubled youth. Let's stop mentioning names, but it wasn't Clive Gosling either, no.
Me, I was instantly just attracted to downhill straight away, so I raced within 2 weeks of getting my first bike. So for me, it was always those bikes I really wanted. And actually, mid-90s, they kind of weren't downhill bikes as such, but things like the GT RTS. Yeah. So a guy at school had the Team RTS with a Tioga disc drive on the back. Yeah. And was a really expensive bike. I couldn't believe he had that bike and rode it at school as a 15, 16-year-old.
That's mental, really, isn't it?
And he raced, actually. The Magura, you know, the yellow Magura hydraulic brakes. Yeah. Just proper dream bike.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine got an RTS when that came... No, LTS, sorry, in anodized red when that came out, and that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah, but those bikes are unbelievable.
And then it went to LTS downhill, so yeah. Nicholas Villiers riding that, you know, with the bend in the seat tube.
Yeah.
That was. I still now have an alert on eBay if any one of those pops up on eBay.
I didn't love that bend.
Nico's got some, yeah.
Has he? I mean, imagine having one of his ones.
He's got a handful of them, yeah.
Because his ones have probably got like slightly different geometry.
Yeah,
or
65 degree head angle back then.
Yeah.
It's insane.
It's just, I remember a picture of him at Cap Die on that bike, and it's just the coolest thing I've ever seen.
That's unbelievable. What about that bent down tube though? Seat tube on it. I never.
I liked
that. Was on the downhill model
because that made it a downhill bike because it just kicked, sort of made it everything look slacker.
Yeah,
I liked it.
Oh, I never got on with that. It always hurt my eyes. My eyes would get distracted.
What would you have, Doddy? If you could pick any.
Easy choice for me is Amp Research BT, which might sound like an alien bike to people, but a lot of people will know it as the Mongoose Amplifier.
Yes, yeah.
So it's the first bike really to have the FSR link, which is called the Horst Link. That's the designer, Horst Leitner.
Mm.
He actually designed that for Specialized.
Right.
And they licensed it and they still use it now.
With that fork, the old leading...
Yeah, the F1 sort of linkage fork on the front.
That must have been heavy, that thing.
It wasn't that heavy, actually. The whole bike weighed 23 pounds in a size medium. It was as light as a cross-country bike when it came out in 93, and I think everyone laughed at it because it was full suspension. But I remember seeing one, I was racing at Eastway, and I had a Saracen Killy Pro Elite or something.
Yeah.
And I saw this guy on the Mongoose, and I was like, that's the best-looking bike I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Fully polished, like twin down tube. It was so nice. Mm. Everything else looked really clunky and the top tubes sloped the wrong way.
Yeah.
It was the first one that looked really aggressive. And
What is easy to forget about those 90s bikes is they almost all broke if you tried to ride them hard. I think I've still got my very first bike, the Cone Lava Dome, which we've done videos on this week. But after that, I broke every frame I had until about 2001. Just because eventually you would crack the head tube. I'm sure you've broken plenty of bikes, Martin.
Oh, God, I've broken a lot of bikes. Yeah, it's actually kind of heartbreaking. I've never liked breaking bikes.
Yeah.
But, sometimes a bike would just... unfortunately, some of the bikes I had to break. I had to break because I'd finished using it and the brand that I rode for didn't want those bikes getting circulated, so you had to actually break them, and it was
really?
Like
it's a bit like the HRC Honda thing.
Oh, it was horrible. Yeah, you had to like stand on the rear chainstays to flatten them, and it was just such a horrible thing to do, because basically when you're finished with them, usually it would be because they don't look quite up to scratch, but yeah, basically are still a fantastic, nearly new bike. Mm. And then you'd have to just end it, and it would be like, oh, killings, I mean, it was terrible.
I guess yours were probably all prototypes as
well. Well, yeah, they were all like prototypes, or they had prototype custom like paint jobs on them, or, you know, sometimes it was for like the just most tiny reason, like they were using cable mounts that they hadn't decided they were going to use yet or something like that, and it would be something like, oh, it's nothing, what difference does it make? But they didn't want anything out there because it affects warranties. Yeah. And so yeah, you'd break a bike because of nearly no reason at all.
But from the outside point of view, I remember growing up and hearing these stories through the magazines about, you know, once you had a prototype bike, you had to get rid of it. And the fact that they were like hen's teeth just made everyone want one of those bikes even more.
Yeah,
because I had a replica. I think I had like an F700 or something similar.
Yeah.
And I dressed it up to try and look like one of your bikes.
But they were pretty much, I mean, there was hardly any difference. Though. Yeah. It was almost always like the sticker pack
but
or something
some
like
difference,
that. You
know? That's what made it cool.
Well, I like to think so. But yeah, I mean, yeah, some of the bikes that the team, you know, the downhill riders had were just...
Well, Cannondale.
Out of this
time,
world bikes.
Berserk bikes, weren't they?
Yeah,
It's funny you were talking about this, because actually when I first started, my first... I got really into it straight away. Went to the bike show at Olympia in 95, and you were there, jumping off the balcony with Martin Hawes on the Cannondales.
Yeah.
I'd imagine Hans Rose there, but I definitely remember you two guys. That's one of my biggest memories of that place.
I think it would have been 1997.
Well, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay. I don't think Hans would have gone that year, but that, I mean, there was that event, and I guess those kind of events... Back in the mid-90s, those events were happening all around the world where there
They're
was these
big
industry shows where a lot of people were going to watch because the energy behind mountain biking had got so big at that point. It was basically the fastest growing sport on the planet, and that was quite often touted by the industry to say, like, this is it, this is the sport. And later on, snowboarding kind of overtook it a bit. But mountain biking had such a huge upsurge.
I remember being so exciting as like a 15-year-old to save my money all year to go there and spend it all on whatever, some sort of a hoodie, a set of bars, a set of airwalk shoes, and then watch all your favourite riders ride. To be fair, most of it, the trials were really good, but do you remember that around the top, there was just like a track that people would pedal around and hit a little bit of a ramp, and that was it.
Yeah,
it was a bit crap.
But you could go up there and ride around that track, and... someone like Rob Warner would ride past you or something, because they were there too, just hanging out. And there's like one of the biggest stars in the sport just rolling around.
There'd be a big bunny hop competition as well with people like Warner and yourself and Steve Gill doing all these
things. If Steve Gill turned up, it was over.
Good, isn't he?
He was amazing. He turned up at one of the bike shows and there wouldn't have been anyone else in the world who would have been anywhere near him on bunny hop at the time. He turned up. We were all desperately trying to scrape over 40 inches, which would be, how high is that in metres? Anyone know?
No, it's high enough, though.
Well, I don't know, maybe 1.10 meters, something like that. And he came up and he did like 46 inches in the first show. And we were all just like, well...
What's the point? Yeah.
Well, Jez Avery was like, career over.
And it was.
I built my... Actually, it wasn't. I follow him on Instagram. He's amazing. Check him out at Jez Avery Stunt Shows, I think it is. He does amazing stunt shows now. And he must be 50...
Like buggies and all sorts.
52 years old, I'm sure.
I'm going to say something controversial here, but do you remember Dirt, not the magazine, the video, the VHS video? It's probably one, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't really like it. I definitely did not like Jez Avery's section. There it is.
Yeah, well,
what I really did like is JMC.
Yes.
Well, that's massively influential.
That was pretty much it.
I mean, you could sell... I mean, the image on the front of that front of that video, and I'm just holding up a Mountain Bike UK video called Dirt with Jason McCraw on the front, riding his Specialized, doing a one-footed manual. He's got no top on, no helmet. He looks like Kurt Cobain.
A pair of Vans.
You could sell a whole sport off of that.
I bid quite a lot of money on eBay for that bike. Didn't get it. I gave up after a couple of grand, I think.
Yeah. What's incredible is that bike, unlike a lot of the bikes you look at back in retro sort of times, it still looks good.
Yeah.
So I've sat on that actual bike. Melbourne's last year. Got a collector bought that one and his FSR. And you look at it in the flesh, it's not far off.
It's
very
cool.
Modern sort of slalom bikes, jump bikes.
It's very, very cool bike. I mean, that that bike was just sort of, that almost is the epitome of a what mountain biking was delivering at that time, and it's something that just wasn't.
There it is. Well, mid-90s, definitely, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think a few cheeky people have uploaded that onto the web. You can find it.
And back in those days, there wasn't much mountain biking stuff to consume, so everything that was out, you just watched over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Mud Cows, I was watching that on YouTube earlier. The Aussies burst onto the scene noisily and messily.
Absolutely crazy. So, interesting thing about Mud Cows, the guy that put all that together was Glenn Jacobs.
Yeah.
So, he did a lot of World Cup cup building. Now, he told me a story that Marin County is well documented as being sort of, just jumping back here a little bit, as being the home of mountain biking where it started. And he's like, well, actually, we were doing the same thing at the same time in Australia. So what's to say that we weren't first?
Yeah, there's been a few of those. I think there was something
Canada's
about...
Canada's had that as well on the shore.
Yeah.
Wade Simmons lived on the shore in 91, and he was like starting a brand new scene coming from BMX into mountain biking. And he was saying it way predates when he was there.
There was a bit of that. I felt a little bit with the whole free ride thing, jumping forward a lot of years, how the throw riders invented free ride. And actually, you've not got a lot too far away from people like Steve Keel and BMX riders in the UK jumping on mountain bikes and doing some pretty big things, even when the sort of Canadians got... Well, they got a lot of recognition for it, rightly so, but it definitely wasn't just them doing it.
Oh, for sure. But I think it probably helped that the fact that they got skiing on their side.
Yeah.
So you could pretty much just put them side by side and identify it as a brand new thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
no. But yeah, no, you're right. It was definitely going on elsewhere. And the Americans shouted about it loudest, that's for sure.
I'm looking at Wikipedia now. The UCI Mountain Bike World Champs, it all kicked off in 1990, was the first official Mountain Bike World Champs. Yeah. So it took a while to get going, really, officially, racing-wise at least. In Durango, I raced the World Cup down on Durango in the early 2000s. It was cool to go there, actually, and sort of be part of that.
I'm trying to imagine, what would the course have been like in 1990 for a downhill race?
It was pretty much fire road.
Yeah.
It was quite big. I think I seem to remember it being like 6-7 minutes or... You know, it's big mountains, really high altitude, they bombed down it. And there was all that controversy that sort of about
Herbold.
Yeah, Greg Herbold won the men's first ever.
And what is the controversy?
That he's cut the course.
No,
is the rumour.
There was an old website called HB Cut the Course in 1990.
No,
it's all based on rumours, of course.
Yeah,
HB is a legend.
Yeah,
you know, he's been in the scene since then. He helped RockShox with the RS1 fork.
Yeah,
he used to wear the old Troy kit way back before anyone was wearing any of that.
I'm thinking of Echo Helmets and Greg Herbold, surely.
Yeah.
Picture
Oh, Eto as well. Eto, yeah. That's right. The adjustments. But the disc wheels, all of that stuff.
He was quite a style icon for quite a few years. Remember that Axo clothing he used to wear?
And Kevlar tights.
Crazy. Disgusting. Crazy colours. Yeah. But somehow he could get away with it. It's kind of like,
did he?
Blonde locks. Like the image flowing was out the back of his helmet. Oh, amazing.
Our image was confused for so long, wasn't it?
Yes.
It's still not quite got one because it kind of borrows.
Me and Doddy haven't really ever stepped out of that image.
Well,
Neil, you came later, but we're still struggling to leave that stuff behind.
Looking at the who won World Champs after Herbold, there's Albert Eyton, I use that as a quiz question somewhere because I've never heard of that guy before.
I have never heard of that man.
Yeah. He used to ride alongside Philippe Perakis.
I've heard of that man. Albert Eyton, a world championship winning mountain biker. I've never heard of him.
Dave Cullinan, a legend, American.
Well, I remember him.
Mike King, another early legend, came from BMX. Francois Gachet, and then it goes into Nicolas Boudil's era where things got more serious, probably, and Nico just started winning everything. And then Sean Palmer came along. And for me, being an impressionable sort of 18-year-old, maybe slightly younger, and seeing someone dressing in Fox kit on riding an intense bike.
Yeah.
You know, I'd definitely grown up on American movies and things. And for me, that was like the new cool of downhill. And it changed the sport, as everyone probably knows, if you know anything about the history of mountain biking. But it was cool being there at the right time to see it, witness all that stuff happen.
Yeah, I mean, Sean Palmer was... it's weird to think back now and think there's obviously lots of young riders now who would never even contemplate who Sean Palmer is or what he did to the sport. But there are names like, I'd say Sean Palmer, for sure in downhill, but there's people in cross country as well. I'm trying to think of someone who would have been really impressionable in the early 90s in cross country. I think Tomac, of course, but maybe someone like Julie Furtado.
Yeah, she won the first one.
She would have been someone we would have been seeing an awful lot on Eurosport. You know, each World Cup was being live streamed, so you could watch those races. And Julie Furtado would have been someone winning week in, week out. Alison Sidor. Obviously, that's where I would have been seeing Tinka Juarez and Tomac. But
a little Sarah Ballantyne, remember?
Yes, yeah. And people like Tim Gould, like a British rider who really was an incredible talent.
Yeah.
Uphill world champion as well.
Climb, he could climb.
He used to do his Acumac, which is kamikaze climb backwards.
Go up the way.
Imagine trying to ride up that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Just looking at the early world champs winners, cross country men's, there's definitely a bit of a crossover between road and cross country to begin with.
Mm.
And that for me is shown most famously, really, with Michael Rasmussen and Philip Meyerhager, two guys that got popped for doping.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the time when it was going on massively in roads, so late 90s, early 2000s. But there's definitely some names there. You think, well, Ryder Hegedal. I don't know if he ever got done, but.
I think you've just done him.
But he is a roadie. Philip Meyerhager, Ryder Hegedal, and Roald Paulussen.
Yeah.
First three at the 2003 Lugano.
Cade Lemons used to be a mountain biker as well.
That's it.
We switched over.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be on a team with Cadel Evans, actually. And he's quite a strange character. He's quite like most roadies, he's quite sort of,
in fact,
a bit of an oddball in the sense that, like, and when I say I'm generalising roadies as in top flight pro roadies, they're people who've spent a lot of time at the very edge of their limits, and I think it may have some mental effect, because I think you've got to be a certain type of person to put yourself through that amount of pain. And I think Cadel was one of those people that you'd see him train and just think, my God, that is something, that is of a level I just don't even understand. And my body is never, ever going to know what he's going through. But somehow he had this mental ability to just try and kill himself on just how far and how long he would ride. And when he came to our team, we were all just blown away. And we had some serious cross-country riders on that team at the time. And he came and schooled them. Like they were like, oh right, we aren't of this kid's level. And he wasn't winning then, but he was obviously about it. Yeah, he's got some great riding skills.
He was
really
in that
good
Chainsmoke video way back
that I think Fox
made with Palmer in there and Kurt Voris.
All
of the sort of the influential Americans, I guess, at the time.
But he was definitely a very cool rider. Interesting dude.
2003 Lugano. Meyerhager got gold. Ryder Hegedal, silver. Roald Paulussen, bronze. All three of them been done for doping.
Wow. I mean, there was definitely a dark time when we go back to his retro days. There was definitely a dark time for cross country mountain biking. It would have been the world champs you first went to, Neil, in Chateau.
No, I was a couple of years later than that. Sweden.
I went to Chateau Day World Champs, and one of the French team was pulled up for running up and down the stairs in the middle of the night trying to keep his heart beating. And the police caught him in the middle of the night, and he was just like, I'm just going for a jog. And it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. So, it's like, why would you do that? I think maybe there was, it happened lots of times, but I remember there being a real bust on the French team's hotel and riders disappearing.
You would hear the rumours being downhill that I don't think there's anyone ever really. There's been a sort of weed offences, but no one's been done for a sort of performance enhancing doping, as far as I'm aware, on the downhill world.
Downhill riders don't do performance enhancing drugs; they do performance debilitating.
But it was always kind of really interesting to hear what was going on in the teams with potentially cross country people. But.
Yeah, well, I always thought when a team. When a team suddenly signs a doctor, you start wondering, what's going on? Because what do we need a doctor for? Physio, yes. Doctor?
So I went to...
Some serious skills.
I raced that 99 World Champs in Sweden as a junior. And so that was the one that Palmer crashed across the finish line. Mm. I think Nico was going to win anyway, but I remember that being just an amazing thing to be at a World Champs and racing.
Yeah,
I was junior. Nathan Rennie won the junior men's by a mile. It was like 12 seconds or something.
Mm. Wow.
And then, it's hard to imagine Nathan Rennie ever being a junior.
Yeah, he was massive.
Massive bloke.
He was massive then. And he broke his ankle at the after party jumping off something.
Yeah.
Sound like a surprise.
Yeah.
Nicolas Bedos won that. Mikhail Pascal second. Eric Carter third.
Yeah. I broke the world bunny hop record at the after party at that event.
Did you?
How high was that then?
It was not as high as I'd have liked. It was probably about 44. It was for the side hop world record, not forward. So it would have been like 44 inches, something like that. You know, I had a few inches.
High.
I had a few inches in the bag, so I'd always just do it a little bit more at lots of events and keep breaking it. I knew how high I could go, and I just thought I'll just keep pushing it up. But I remember that party, and that was
it was good.
I started the beginning of the night breaking a world record, and I think I broke a new puking record by the end of it.
I remember it stopped raining for the 10 days we were there, but
it was a tough event.
But talking about the sort of early 2000s, late 90s, people like Nico just dominated, and Caroline Chausson, downhill, they were just unbeatable forces almost at the time. And the bikes were really changing, sort of mid to late 90s. They're really, like, if you were on the right bike, it would make a massive difference. And slightly earlier than that, there's things like Sun Chippy. Do you remember that team?
Radical Plus.
Amazing. Oh, yeah. A friend of mine, Shrewsbury, had one. And it was just so ahead of its time that if you didn't have that bike, you just couldn't go as fast.
I think there's a weird thing that, like, a lot of the French races, there's a lot of correlation with bike development over the years. They seem so much more focused on getting the right setup, the right geometry, the right suspension.
Yeah.
Like, way more than anyone else seemed to be.
Yeah.
They got on with it. And
true. And they had Nico, Pascal, Cedric Gracia, Fabien Borel.
And Caroline.
And Caro, yeah.
Yeah.
Just an incredible team at the time. And probably more people than that. I remember.
It was unbelievable. Am I right in thinking that once Nico went to GT, which year would he have gone
that
to GT? Maybe 90th. Not sure what year he would have gone to GT.
He was GT earlier, wasn't he? And then he went to Sun.
Because
he got on a bike that was a lot heavier.
Oh, right, yeah. Of course, it's the other way around.
I don't think it was alloy steel, but it was a lot heavier than the GTs.
Right. Then, yeah, no, I've got it.
I can't remember.
You're right.
Yeah.
But then the bike ended up being far better.
Yeah, the GTs weren't that great, were they, really? As cool as they looked.
He developed his own bikes, didn't he?
Yeah, that's what I was getting to, because he was having GTs, Sun's welded, like, in his own kind of little facility, wasn't he? He was having sort of geometries done to his bike and hacking them up.
He still does that.
He's still doing it now. Yeah. His e-bike, Steve Jones was telling me, his e-bike is all hacked about. He's got a motor. And he's changed it all. So I guess that's just part of his makeup.
Well, early days, he worked with Olivier Bossard a lot with the Sun bikes and the V Process bikes that he made.
The guy
who does Boss suspension. Still does Boss suspension, I believe. Still going?
Right.
Oh, okay.
I mean, Fabien Borel still speaks really highly of those Radical Plus bikes.
Yeah.
He reckons, you know, I think they had like 4-inch travel or something back then.
Yeah.
He reckons they'd still cut it on the right course now.
Yeah. And so Fabien is so another, good. He's another rider that is meticulous about setup. And now I did see him giving a, I don't know who it was, I saw him hugging on the finish line of the last World Cup downhill race.
Hmm.
I think it might have been, I guess he's helping out.
Still working on Canyon stuff.
Canyon, so I guess bites. Troy would have been on the podium.
Sure,
yeah.
So,
yeah, I think it might have been Loic.
Yeah.
But I just wondered, I wonder how much involvement, how close-knit that French community is, that they're supporting each other.
I don't think it is quite as close as you might think.
No?
I think some of the new school French boys sort of want to move away from that a little bit. That's what I've heard, reading between the lines.
I reckon I don't reckon they're cool at all. I think they're all really very calculated, genius racers, and they're just making us think they're cool because they've learned from the mistakes of Nico, who was a genius racer, but so not cool.
Richard's finding his tattoo now. He's really cool.
Yeah, it's weird. Now he's become cool. It's the other way around now.
I think in hindsight, I was definitely in the Steve Peat camp because he helped me out really early.
Yeah.
And at that time, you were kind of Steve Peat or you were Nico. You had to choose your side and stick to it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And I was definitely on the Steve Peat side
to
of things.
Fair, I think most people on the Steve Peat side.
Yeah. But actually looking back, I'm like, actually, Nico was cooler than I thought at the time.
Yeah.
And he did things so differently because we were brought up on... you have to party hard and you need to race downhill bike fast, whereas Nico didn't really do that. He just raced. That was his thing. Yeah. And now looking back, I think, well, actually, who was the stupid one? Was it me or was it Nico?
Well, so I think a lot
over the years is amazing. It reminds me a little bit of Hunt and Lauda.
Yeah.
In the car stakes, you know.
Yeah, it's very similar. Yeah, similar kind of thing, similar characters.
PT and they loved him back then. He's a character of the sport.
Yeah.
Made people want to do it.
Yeah.
Nico was just quiet.
Yeah,
unassuming guy that would just get on with it and do it.
Yeah, but think Nico saw off. I mean, Steve Peat's one name, but he saw off a lot of people.
Yeah,
there was just so many good riders who just could not topple that guy.
Won 10 world championships and retired at the age of 26.
That's just bonkers, isn't it?
Doesn't even seem possible.
Looking at a list of the riders that are under him: Palmer, Tomac, Goen Peters, Pascal, PT, Minar.
Do you remember seeing the video? One of the old World Cup videos. Goen Peters won the World Cup, shook up the champagne, popped the top off, and he was looking at it, and it hit him straight in the eyeball. And he had a massive black eye the day after.
Oh, I don't know. Oh, you never really had those characters in the cross country scene, did you? Like, downhill definitely brought in some brilliant characters back in the day, but cross country never really brought any party animals in the sport, but I guess that's the nature of the sport, is that they're not
kind of thing to do, isn't it?
They're not part. But Tomac was cool.
Yeah.
Well, Tomac did everything. He was a pro roadie as well as a pro mountain biker at the same time.
Imagine that. A cool roadie. Unbelievable.
Well, we've got Matthew Vanderpool now, who's doing that everything better than Tomac did.
That's two cool roadies that sport's brought out.
Tomac did BMX as well, and he's got motocross racing son, so he's kind of a little bit cool.
Yeah.
Tomac doesn't really have much to do with mountain biking anymore, as far as I'm aware.
Nah, I guess
not.
I wonder, I've never met John Tomac. I would love to one day meet John Tomac, but I wonder if you meet him, if he's a little bit like one of those sporting legends that, to you, he's everything in the sport, but to him, it's just something he did when he was younger.
Yeah, maybe.
I remember meeting a guy. I come from motorcycle trials. That was my background before I was into mountain biking. And there was a world champion in 1979, 1980, something like that, called Bernie Schreiber, an American guy. He ended up being involved in mountain biking, actually, because he used to work for Tiso, who used to be a sponsor of the sport at the World Cup level.
Yeah.
And I met him at one of these mountain bike events. I was like, oh my God, it's Bernie Schreiber, literally one of the most unbelievable legends in the sport that I adored. And when I asked him about it, it was almost as though he couldn't remember anything. He was like, yeah, I did used to ride motorbikes a bit. And you're like, you're Bernie Schreiber, you rode, and I wonder if Tomac would be a bit like that. Would he be like, I did a race.
He's really mellow. He's respecting, he's a farmer.
Yeah.
Back then as well, Farmer John. Tyres named after him.
Yeah. Is that right? Is that what that's...
Farmer John, Farmer John's cousin, Farmer John's nephew. Three terrible tyres. It didn't matter because you buy them because they had his name on them.
Because they had John Tomac on them.
There's lots of cool people. I've not met many people who aren't that cool. You know, the old legends of mountain biking.
Well, time does a great thing. Like, now we can look back on Nico and say, yeah, actually, he was kind of cool.
Well,
time is very kind sometimes.
Well, I met him really first time only a couple of years ago riding e-bikes, and it was wicked. I got on really well with him.
Yeah. But I think he was wicked the whole time. We just had Steve Peat goggles on. We couldn't see past them. He was nice. He was a nice guy. He was wondering, why don't you like me? I'm really nice.
It's strange that no one liked him to start with, because his entrance when he came in, like, those early races, yeah. Cap Dyer, where he came in, just destroyed everyone.
Yeah, he was very.
Like, who's he?
Yeah, and he wasn't the most. He was slightly arrogant going over the finish line a few times.
Well, I think he celebrated no-handed before he'd even gone through the line.
Yeah, and I don't think that really makes other racers love you. If you make everyone look like a total fool, then.
But plenty of people are not going to be loved. No one loves them. Kvarek of Fort William, 14 seconds clear in a skin suit.
Yeah.
Everyone loved him for it.
Yeah, but I think one thing I'd say is that we mentioned Sean Palmer earlier. Mm. As Sean Palmer has not won that much stuff, but what we do love him for is the aggression he showed when he comes over the finish line 0.2 of a second behind Nico and then swears on his life he's going to steal the gold off that guy in the next year. And you just think, seeing that passion come out of someone is amazing and it makes you love them. But you don't get the really serious people who win time and time again. They don't tend to show that emotion, do they? They don't tend
to be content
on
the podium.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're like, right, it's all about just getting the results. Yeah. And
he didn't care about anything, so the pole, did he?
No, I mean, I
have you seen that footage of him at Cairns where he comes through the line and he's, like you said,
livid.
Just off, he froze his goggles on the floor and he's pissed off.
Yeah, he really is. I actually, that's the first time I ever met him. I didn't know who the hell he was. He came over to the back of the Volvo truck and asked if he could borrow some tyres because he didn't have any tyres. And I just remember seeing a guy with loads of tattoos and a suntan and a bald head, all shaved hair. And I thought, and I was like, who's that dude? And the mechanic, who was a really cool guy called Tim, he said, that's actually the world snowboard champion. And I just remember thinking, what's he doing here? And then he came second.
I've got a great photo actually taken by Jeff Orr of the motocross pants he was wearing at that event.
Yeah.
And on the back of him, it says summer job.
I mean, that kind of marketing, that sort of astute marketing, that's very rare. I mean, like, that's really, well, confidence is, showing confidence like that is also
was it
pretty
confidence,
ballsy.
Was it arrogance? A bit of both.
It was big news at the time, himself and April Lawyer, if you remember,
came
from snowboarding, and it was sort of gave a bit of...
For Maxis and stuff, didn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a bit of a cool factor coming over to mountain biking and other people from big, cool spots coming and doing really well at it, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess if you've got used to that kind of speed and you can handle it in other sports, it's going to help you when you come across. I don't know if you could do it now.
We seem to understand the sort of mental attitude.
Mm.
Because you look at the top 20 in whatever category, and I think a lot of the riders and racers are really equally, like, if you pair them up against each other.
Yeah.
It seems to be, once you get a podium, we get closer, you go into a different realm of your mental attitude.
Yeah.
But Palmer seemed to have that from the start, regardless of any results.
Yeah, Cedric Grazia was another rider who, he was actually a skier.
Yeah,
you know, that was what he wanted to be and do, and like mountain biking, that was literally his summer job.
Corrado Herrin was an Olympic luger, showed up in 97 and won everything pretty much.
Yeah, am I right in thinking Corrado Herrin passed away
recently?
Yeah, that's really sad.
But yeah, there's a lot of those fast Euros back in the sort of mid 90s, and then Palmer shows up and starts beating him, but.
Yeah. Who's the name for you? Palmer for you, Neil?
Well, I don't know, actually. Sort of looking back now, maybe not. At the time, Palmer was super cool, but now, people like Nico, some of the Americans, Eric Carter, Brian Lopes, those sort of people, definitely looked up to.
Yeah, what about you, Dolly?
Hans Rey?
Wow. Yeah, maybe I would have to...
The first time I saw him was at Bicycle Expo before I'd seen you.
Yeah.
And he was dancing on his back wheel to Rhythm as a Dancer. Remember that?
Yes.
Really bad '90s tune.
That sounds bad, but it was good.
At the time,
I promise
it was amazing.
Yeah,
and
I promise
you. I remember
it was
watching
good.
Him bunny hop clean onto the roof of a car.
Yeah.
And just be like, that's not possible. No one could do that on a mountain bike.
Yeah. And, well, I would have to say Hans is almost like my go to. But I think, thankfully, because of her results, she's not forgotten. But someone who's just incredibly impressive was Anne Carrow. I just thought, she was something special on a bike. You know, I mean, it's been very few, just because of their difference in times. There's been very few female racers that the male racers would watch and admire. Yeah. That hasn't happened many times, just because the time difference is there and. the only reason you would do that now is because of Ancaro existed. You know, she just made the sport of female downhill racing, and I think mountain biking, leap forward so far.
When I still remember front cover of a magazine, it was MBI, and I think at the time it was edited by Chris Porter.
I'm trying to think of what the trick was. One hand.
No, she was doing just like a bit of a cross up. And she was on the Sun Chippy team. She had like an open faced BMX style helmet with a mouth guard.
Yeah.
And the whole story was about the fact she was jumping all of the doubles and all the jumps.
Yeah.
And like most of the British guys couldn't jump them. And she was jumping everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, who the hell is this?
Yeah. So check it out, right? That would have been Metabi. That would maybe be the first Worlds that Rob Warner went to, maybe 1992.
Yeah.
Like that, 1993.
Yeah.
Ancaro won gold at the Olympics in 2008.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's how long she was that good.
Yeah.
She beat Sinead Reed, you know, in BMX. I mean, that hasn't happened, I don't think, or will ever again, you know. I mean, can you imagine anyone else being talented?
Who are the future legends we see now at the World Cup? I'm guessing, like, cross-country, Schurter is that man. Maybe potentially Matthew Van Der Poel if he continues, but he's going to go to road.
Sounds like he's focusing on the Olympics.
Yeah.
Like that is,
the Olympic cycle is having a big impact now on how people think about their career, isn't it? Because it's such a huge event to win, and it makes such a big difference to your career and probably your financial power in the sport.
Yeah.
So I think those cross country guys are always looking at that. If you remember the last Olympics, we saw Sagan coming over and trying to get a gold in mountain biking.
He was just too aggressive, wasn't he?
But he definitely showed that he might have threatened Schurter there. So it's interesting to see.
I think his struggle now, though, with the course changes and stuff, I think it's got more aggressive.
Yeah.
The riding level is in all categories is so high compared to what it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's across the sport, isn't it? I mean, definitely in downhill, in cross country, if anyone out there who's watching or listening knows anything about trials riding, if you look at trials now to the Hans Rey we knew, it's a world apart.
Yeah,
it really is a world apart.
You look at the cross-country tracks now, like I've been doing this week trying to ride an old bike, and you realise actually how much more technical things are now. You need a 29er full suspension bike most of the time for those trails, they're pushing so hard everywhere that things are just technical and they're physical.
So in this retro week that we've got going, that's going to be happening for the next few days on GMBN, you guys have been riding some old bikes. And me and Doddy were in the lift the other day, and you were saying, oh my God, this bike's killed me. What was it you were riding?
It was a GT Shazang, so the titanium triple triangle frame.
Yeah.
And it had 140mm stem on it, and a bar that's, I didn't measure it, but less than 500mm.
Yeah.
And it was way too long for me. It was a really nice bike.
Yeah,
to look at.
Really hard to ride.
Yeah, and what made it hard to ride? Just that length of
thing.
Almost
laying down, almost out the front door. And then I tried to keep it real and keep the saddle high, which was a bit of a mistake.
You got a bit of a buck.
Had a bit of a squashed item,
Oh, nice.
And what were you on there? I've been riding my old Cone Lavdome, which is a 1989 bike, and it's just my original bike that I've kept as a commuter. And I've just been fixing it all week, basically, putting new brake blocks on it, putting Coke can in the head tube because it's flared even more. Just doing crap things to try and make the bike work. And you forget now, you know, I'm not the best at bike maintenance nowadays, but you can ride a bike, put it away, and you really don't have to do so much. You know it's going to work, and you don't break them. Well, I don't break them anymore, at least. And I actually love a 29er enduro bike, so going back to a fully rigid 26 inch wheel bike is very, very rough. And I tried to ride it with flat pedals down a downhill track, and you can literally hear my feet doing this on the pedals the whole way down as I'm trying to stay on it.
The wheels getting swallowed by the holes as well?
Yeah, holes.
26 isn't dead. It's gone.
Oh, man. And I think the tracks, obviously, they're probably, you know, bigger wheels ride through those holes and make them bigger. So now riding a little wheel just seems so much worse.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some photos recently because we've been looking at this retro stuff of some of the taller riders on older mountain bikes, and they look ridiculous. people like Steve Peepshaw, Rob Warner. You see Rob Warner on one of his old Pro Giants, and the wheels just looked so stupid.
Well, they're so close together.
Yeah, it's worse. Yeah, the bike's so short, and he's so massive over the bike. And
okay, then there's a good one. So I've been looking through. Well, Sun Chippy, I googled to see the old pictures, and there's Steve riding that Lobo, and he looks massive. Oh, actually, that's the bike I rode at 99 World Champs, because Steve was injured and he lent me his bike, which didn't fit me very well because I was a lot smaller than Steve Pete.
Yeah.
John Tomac. But yeah, Cedric Gracia hanging off the front of his Sun Chippy.
Wow, that's a position,
isn't it? Just the bikes look so small.
Yeah, they've looked frighteningly short, and the wheels don't look like they can handle it.
And steep head angles as well.
But isn't it funny what kind of happened in the middle from where we are now to where it started? Because when me and Neil were in Marin County at the museum, we noticed all those original bikes. They're actually pretty long, pretty slack, like 67-ish head angles.
Yeah.
Massive bullhorn handlebars on them.
Yeah.
Tiny little stems.
Yeah.
And in the middle, we kind of got short wheelbase and really long stems and really narrow bars.
Yeah, yeah.
Steep angles. And thankfully, we've come out the other side of it.
Yeah.
What's the worst bike you've ever ridden? I've ridden, for this job, actually, the last couple of years, I've ridden some pretty bad bikes. ProFlex. That Trek, what was that Trek called? Nine something, maybe?
That Scott Downhill bike you had.
The one with the elastomer rubber and a super high pivot.
Yeah, and it's single pivot. That was just terrible.
I find it very hard to not like a bike. So I don't, and sometimes when a bike's very bad, I think it makes you love it more. But I don't want to say any of the bad bikes I've ridden because it feels awful.
One.
No, I don't want to say. Well, it's not being nice. I just sort of feel like I'd be like...
You'll tell us after this, so you might as well tell us now.
No, I'm not going to say. There's one particular bike I'm thinking of, and it's,
But I do think now, you, like I said before, but basically you get complacent to how good things are now until you ride an old bike and realise how good you've got it.
Yeah. Actually, to save myself on the bike that I didn't like, I'll say one of my own that I designed. One of the first bikes I designed was like, it was a trials bike, and it was way too short, and I just wanted it to look good. And I made it so, as a trials rider at the time, you would have thought it looked good, but then you rode it and thought,
yeah,
we need to change the geometry on this. And I did in the following edition. about you, Dolly? What's one you hate?
I don't know. I've ridden a lot of bad stuff over the years.
You must have ridden so many mountain bikes.
Probably the bike that makes the least amount of sense was that old slingshot thing. You seen
those? Yeah. I've never ridden
one. The cable is a down tube and had a rubber elastomer on the top tube. It used to shrink and then extend again.
Have you ever ridden mountain cycle, San Andreas?
Yeah. Not bad.
Right, I always wanted one. No,
they're not bad. The early ones had elastomer shocks, which you should just burn them, to be fair. But Paul Smith's one with the Rissy Racing rear shock on there. Like, it's not a bad bike, even by today's standards. It's a little bit short and stuff, but it still works.
Yeah, lovely looking thing. It's crazy, isn't it?
And that Foz I rode for the video over on GMBN, other than the stupid long stem and tiny bars on it, back end felt pretty good.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, it's like an orange, really.
Yeah,
For a 1994.
Yeah. That was the brand I was not going to mention. The orange. I've done it now. Yeah, there was an orange I had that I just thought was such a pile of crap.
All right, so I think we've whittled on about retro bikes enough.
I could go on another hour easy. I'm going to be quiet.
All right, we're back to a more standard podcast next week. We've got the Enduro World Series in France. Not sure who we've got coming for that one yet. And then it's World Cup racing again, downhill and cross country week after that. So thanks for listening.
Whammy.
Yeah, and keep your eyes peeled on GMBN and Tech for more retro stuff this week.